This episode of The Transmission is brought to you by Audible.com, the leader in spoken word entertainment.
Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. For details, go to audiblepodcast.com/transmission.
The Transmission, episode 51, February 8th, 2009.
Doesn't make any sense. Those yahoos have been here for months. I've never been here before 2 weeks ago.
Are you sure about that?
Aloha from the Island Lost fans. You are tuned into The Transmission. This is a podcast devoted to the show Lost on ABC. I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan, and we're here to discuss the latest, greatest episode of Lost, The Little Prince. So how are we going to break it down?
We'll recap the episode in 8 minutes or less.
Then we're going to take a step back and look at it in greater detail.
We hear from you all, everybody, in our feedback segment.
And finally, we're going to step into the forward cabin, this time with a special set report from our friend, Chris J. You ready?
Let's get lost.
So, episode 4 of season 5 of Lost, The Little Prince. We've got stuff off-island and on, so let's start off the island.
On Penny's boat, Jack and Kate are talking about what they're going to do about Aaron. Kate tells Jack that Aaron was going to be put up for adoption. She says that they should say that Aaron is her son and that she was 6 months pregnant when they crashed. Kate says she's lost so many people in her life, she can't lose any more.
Well, Jack says Sawyer's not dead, but Kate says, but he's gone. Eventually, Jack agrees, but then tells Kate that she has to back him up on the plan to lie. He says that he's going to have to convince everyone, so he has to know that she's with him. She says, "I have always been with you."
3 years later, Kate borrows some clothes from Sun. Sun is going to watch Aaron. She says, "We'll be fine." Kate thanks Sun for helping her, and Sun says, "It's what any friend would do." Kate leaves as a delivery arrives for Sun. It's a file of photos of Ben and Jack and a box of chocolates hiding a gun.
Kate goes to see Mr. Norton, the lawyer, and she says that she'll give them the blood samples if she can talk to his client. He says that she's not in much of a position to make a deal, and he says that his client wants to make the exchange of custody happen quietly. He says, "You better prepare yourself. You are going to lose the boy."
Jack is treating Saeed, saying he's got to take it easy as he was pumped full of horse tranquilizer, but Saeed needs to go rescue Hurley. Jack says not to worry. Ben is on our side, but Saeed says the only side Ben is on is his own. A hospital administrator comes and tells Jack he can't be there.
But Jack gets a call from Hurley, who says that he's in prison, and he's proud that he did exactly what Saeed said to do. Meanwhile, an orderly goes to Saeed and says he's got to give him his meds. He pulls a gun, but Saeed gets the jump on him, and Saeed shoots him with tranquilizers and takes an address out of his wallet. It's 42 Panorama Crest.
Jack realizes that that's Kate's address and calls Kate to ask where she is. She says that she's downtown, and Jack says, "Let me meet you there." Ben says he'll go get Hurley, but Saeed says, "I'm not letting you anywhere near him." Ben tells Saeed that his friends are in danger and he can deal with the dirty laundry later.
So Jack goes to Kate and asks what's going on. Kate says that someone's trying to take Aaron. Suddenly she notices the lawyer driving away and tells Jack to jump in. They follow him to a motel and see that his client is Claire's mother. Jack says that he'll go to her and explain why they did it and he'll fix it. He says, "Aaron is my family too."
Jack tells Claire's mom that everything that he did and Kate did is for Aaron, but she asks, "Who's Aaron?"
No.
Jack runs back to Kate and tells her Claire's mom doesn't even know anything and that she's just trying to collect the Oceanic settlement. Kate asks if Claire's mom isn't trying to take Aaron, who is?
Cut to Ben and Saeed driving to a parking garage. Mr. Norton shows up and tells Ben that there's not much of a case against Hurley. The man at the mental institution was dead before Hurley escaped, so Hurley will probably go free. When Mr. Norton leaves, Saeed asks who that was, and Ben says, "Oh, that's my lawyer."
Jack and Kate arrive at the marina to wait for Ben and Saeed. Kate asks why Jack called. Jack says a man attacked Saeed in the hospital and her address was in his pocket. He says he wants to get her and Aaron just to go someplace safe. Saeed and Ben drive up and Kate is floored.
Yep, Jack says that Ben's with him and that Ben's there to help. And that's when Kate realizes that Ben sent the lawyer. Ben says, "Yeah, it was me. Sorry. When Jack tries to explain, Sun is parked nearby. With Aaron sleeping in the back seat, she grabs her gun and gets out of her car.
Back on the island, Daniel and Juliet are tending to Charlotte. Sawyer is upset, but Juliet sends him away. Juliet asks Daniel what's going on. Daniel says it's neurological and that the flashes are like really bad jet lag. Juliet asks why it isn't happening to anyone else, and Miles has no idea.
Locke tells Sawyer that they all have to go back to the Orchid, where all this started and where it might stop. Sawyer says that's far away, but Locke says they could take the Zodiac around the island. He says that this is all happening because they left.
Sawyer says he knows the freighter blew up, but Locke says they're not dead and he has to make them come back, even if it kills him. Locke asks Sawyer, don't you want them to come back? Don't you want her to come back? Charlotte wakes up. Miles asks, now what? Sawyer says, we're going to the Orchid.
So they're on their way. They see a light in the jungle, and Miles asks what it is. Locke says that whatever it is, we better stay clear. Miles asks John what time they're in, but Locke says they have to keep moving. Suddenly, Miles notices that he has a bloody nose, too.
Suddenly, they hear screaming in the forest. Sawyer goes to investigate. He sees the scene in season one where Kate is helping Claire give birth to Aaron. Then in a flash, they're gone. Locke walks up and asks what he saw, and Sawyer says, it doesn't matter because they're gone now.
Locke says that they both know when they are, and Sawyer asks how Locke knows. Locke says that he saw that light the night that Boone died. Sawyer asks why he's steering them away when you could go tell yourself to do something else and avoid all that pain. Locke says that he needed that pain to get to where he is now.
Miles tells Daniel that he just got a nosebleed and asks why it's happening to him and Charlotte. Daniel says it may be related to the duration of exposure. Miles says he's never been to the island, but Daniel asks, are you sure? They arrive at the beach camp, but it's empty.
In fact, the camp is in disarray, and Daniel notices that the Zodiac is gone. Miles notices two canoes sitting on the beach, and inside they find an Ajira Airlines water bottle.
They take a canoe. Sawyer tells Juliet that he saw Kate delivering Claire's baby. Juliet realizes that was 2 months ago. Sawyer says, time travel's a bitch. Suddenly, there's another canoe following them and shooting at them.
Juliet shoots back and hits someone in that canoe. Meanwhile, a bullet goes through Sawyer's oar. The other canoe is gaining on them, but a flash starts to happen and Sawyer yells, thank you, Lord! After the flash, though, they're in the middle of a storm at night and Sawyer says, I take that back!
They get ashore and need to rest until light. Juliet asks Sawyer how it felt to see Kate. He says he was close enough to talk to her. She asks, why didn't you? And he says, what's done is done. He notices Juliet has a nosebleed as well.
Charlotte finds wreckage on the beach and a box labeled Bessie's Doos. And they cut to stormy seas on the water and French people on a life raft. They see something floating nearby and paddle to it. It's a body floating on a wooden plank. They pull him aboard, and it's Jin!
Jin! Jin wakes up on the beach. The French shipwreck survivors are checking their supplies. Meanwhile, a radio is reading off the numbers in the background. A woman checks on Jin, realizing that he speaks a little English. She asks how he got there. He says, boat.
Boat.
They ask him what boat, and he says it's gone.
Jin notices that the woman is pregnant, and she goes to bring him some water. She asks his name, and he says he's Jin. And she says her name is Danielle Russo.
And thud.
And that is The Little Prince in under 8 minutes, and we're going to catch our breath, and when we come back, we'll give you our 2 cents on the episode. Welcome back, and we can't wait to share our thoughts on The Little Prince and get to you all, everybody. But first, we want to let you know that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. The leading provider in spoken word entertainment.
Audible has over 50,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like the transmission. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Audible.com, you can get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today.
I mean, if you've always wanted to read the many books mentioned on Lost, Audible is a great way to go. For example, I saw that you can pick up The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien. It's the unabridged version as well, and it's narrated by Jim Norton. You read the book.
Yes, I did read the book.
But I think you'd might be kind of cool to hear it. And, you know, Jim Norton's actually a comedian. He's done a lot of shows. He's actually got kind of a blue streak going. I'm not sure if that ties in with the book or not. But it's a great way. I mean, it's a very surreal story, so he makes it even more enjoyable that way.
Actually, the story of the third policeman is really relevant here in season 5, because what happens in the book is kind of happening on the show now.
Oh, so if you want to find out how that might work, you can check it out. Make it your free pick with this offer.
Just go to audiblepodcast.com/transmission today.
All right. So what did you think about The Little Prince?
I loved it.
You loved it. Did you love it as much as Jughead?
No, Jughead is really hard to top, but I thought it was still a pretty solid episode.
Yeah, I think, in fact, they're kind of good companion episodes. They both had a lot of connections and links that really got us excited. I mean, when I saw that beam of light in the jungle, it just made my heart stop for a moment, because that is the iconic image of Lost. Lost season 1, in fact. So really, to have that kind of a link and to remember how thrilling the show was back then just kind of got my juices flowing this week. And in fact, again, there was Oceanic 6 stuff, but it wasn't all Oceanic 6. And in fact, the Oceanic 6 stuff wasn't all that bad. And meanwhile, on the island, just really great connections, and the two big ones have got to be Jin is alive.
Yes.
Jin is alive. Thank God Almighty, he's
and
back.
And Russo.
Yes, in fact, he is with Russo in the past, I guess in the 80s when her ship first shipwrecks on the island. And I think that was absolutely fantastic.
I loved it. I was so excited to see the French team, you know, how it all started, and to see it really made me, it was thrilling.
Right. It's basically going to kind of tell us what happened with them and really moving to, I think, an important period in the island's history.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here's one thing I noticed about the Oceanic 6 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the conflict on the island in the past seasons has been from the survivors not talking to each other and withholding
right.
things and lying and mm-hmm. generally, you know, not cooperating with each other. And seeing the Oceanic 6 in this episode reminds me that they're still doing that. Mm. You know, even when the survival of the people back on the island hinges on them getting together, they still cannot get together and cooperate.
Yeah. I think that's definitely true, a fair observation. I think, though, that in the history of drama and in the standard canon of storytelling, if everybody communicated, you'd have a very short show. But I agree. In many ways, I think we were originally beginning to think that the Oceanic 6 got off and that they begin to resolve their issues and change and become different people as a result of what happened to them. But we find out very early on throughout season 4 that they have not changed, that many of their main traits still persist and get. And definitely it's kind of shooting them in the foot or definitely slowing things down off the island. I thought it was kind of interesting that one thing we're definitely seeing is that these are not character-centric episodes. It's not a Kate episode. It's not a Sawyer episode. It's just sort of an everybody moving along story. And
yeah.
I guess in many ways, if you're not a fan of a particular character, that would be good, because sometimes you're just like, I don't want to see this person's story anymore. I'm not interested in this person. Let's get to my favorite character. Now you have it. You've got sort of a buffet. You kind of touch on everybody in both places, like in this episode. But on the other hand, I kind of think that it seems more shallow. I mean, there's just not as much depth to it, and that there are only certain scenes where everything comes to a halt, where we can have a very deep and intense conversation, but then it moves along. I mean, there's really not that depth that we're used to, I think.
Yeah, well, that may be so, but I think that we've already learned as much about the characters as is relevant to the story.
So we're just sort of, we just got to see them get busy.
I think so.
Jobs.
I think so. That's why I don't really mind so much that they're not centric anymore.
Well, you know, one of the things that came up in our comments and on our last show, of course, was Robin at the TVCritic.org and his comment about emotional resonance. And now that's sort of a catchphrase that's bouncing around in my head. And it just makes me wonder if that's what is maybe feeling a little different about this season. Not that they're giving us answers and that's what the difference is, but that we've moved beyond the deep and personal explorations and we've moved basically to plot. And also a comment that came up that definitely now hits me over the head when we watch Lost is that there's something going on with the anvilicious editing.
Yeah.
Ever since episode 1 of season 5, it's like, so who's going to be the person who can stop this from happening? Cut to Locke. You know, who's the person that's trying to take Aaron? Cut to Ben. I mean, there's no subtlety at all as far as giving us hints about what's going on.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I did. I'm not sure that there's any other way. I mean, just because of the way the plot is moving along, you know, they don't have a lot of time to spare.
Yeah, I do think that it's kind of difficult to not do that, in the sense that if you're going to be jumping between time periods, different locations, and now you're not focusing on one character, it's quite possible that you could get lost, no pun intended, following all these pieces if they don't connect it somehow with just a little stitch. I guess I just want that stitch to be a little, I don't want to be able to feel the seam as much as I am. But some things in the episode worked out. I thought the Oceanic Six side was pretty good, and the whole thing with Claire's mom was kind of cool.
It was a double fake out.
Yeah, it was a double fake out, and there was such a great sense of satisfaction for a lot of us, and myself included, that, aha, it was Claire's mom. Of course that's who's involved here. And then it turns out it's not. So I thought, on one hand, they're kind of messing with us, but on the other hand, I like that. Sometimes it feels good to be messed with.
Well, wasn't it great when we found out that actually was Ben? Didn't you love that little, sorry?
Oh, yeah. Michael Emerson's delivery in that one line, I think, is definitely one of my favorite moments in this entire episode. Oh, yeah, it was me. Sorry, you know, with a little shrug, like a little comic character just saying, oh, yeah, sorry, I was the one messing with your life. That was absolutely fantastic.
So who is Sun working for?
You know, I go back and forth. I'm like, well, she's meeting with Widmore. She says we have similar aims, similar objectives. We both want to kill Ben Linus. So in many ways, what she's doing seems to serve that. But on the other hand, because of how her movement in and her character development and what's motivating her and what looks like is pushing her toward Ben, it seems like that she could also be part of that same conspiracy.
She's working for herself. I think she's angry, and I think she's doing whatever it takes to get rid of that anger. She's doing whatever it takes to get back who took Jin away from her. And she's just going to do whatever she has to do to whoever she has to do it to.
Right. I mean, I think last week or the week before, I was convinced that Sun was actually working with Ben. But the more we are shown of her doing genuine things as a person, I mean, she's not just doing things in front of other people to look mad at Ben. She's actually doing things by herself that imply she's mad at Ben. Nobody saw her pull the gun out of the box of chocolate and looking at the pictures of Ben and Jack together. So that's not a front she's putting on in her bedroom. No. So I think that there's many strong hints that either she's in cahoots with Widmore or at least genuinely not happy with Ben at all.
So Daniel tells us basically what's going on with the nosebleeds.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was pretty cool. And of course, they're giving you a chronology there now of the island's history. We've got Charlotte, who was born on the island, as were strongly implied. So she was the first to be going through this. And who was next after?
Miles.
And then Miles. And Miles' strong theory is that he's Marvin Candle's baby that we saw. Mm-hmm. So he'd get a nosebleed. And finally, we've reached Juliet, who's a fairly contemporary addition to the island.
Right.
So I would say that if Juliet's getting a nosebleed now, pretty much the rest of our losties are going to join in the hemorrhage fest.
Well, except for Daniel. I mean, because he's got a constant, right?
See, you know, I'm beginning to think that there's going to be some serious head scratching or frustration here, because I think that there are two things going on here. You've got the consciousness ship slipping through time, where you're leaving a body behind, and because you're jumping back and forth, you're getting really bad jet lag. And is that or is that not what's happening with them? I'm not sure, because I get the feeling that it's their whole selves that are moving around.
Yeah.
So independent of that constant argument, you have the exposure to the island, and more, the longer you've been there, the longer you've been anchored to a specific time, so that being in a different time is more dangerous for you. But because there's those two ways you can get nosebleeds running around, I have no idea which is which. And you know, when people start saying it's a constant that, it's a constant this, and maybe he's their own constant or something, it really starts to tie my brain in knots. But mentioning Daniel is really key to me, because if it's the length of time you've been on the island and anchoring you there and then moving around is dangerous for you, well, we just saw in the very first scene of season 5, Daniel Faraday way back in the history of the island,
in
right?
In the 70s.
In the building of the Orchid Station, I guess.
Right.
So if he was there, then he certainly would, you would think, at some point be given credit for having been on the island longer than almost anyone else. He could have jumped back to even before Charlotte was born, for example.
Yeah, so yeah.
I'm totally confused by that, and I think that the conversation about that's going to continue indefinitely until we get sort of them sorted out. Okay, this is a constant nosebleed. This is a time travel nosebleed. Get it straight.
Right, yeah. Well, it seems like the main concept that they were trying to introduce in this episode was the idea of them running into themselves on the island.
Right, absolutely. You know, very early on in this season, we had Miles steering them away from bumping into themselves, moving them to the hatch instead of to the beach, and then moving them back to the beach when the hatch comes back. So you got the sense already that he's trying to avoid that. And here they're basically explicitly saying, oh, there's the light from the hatch. Let's not go there. And Sawyer, because of some deep and emotional reason, decides not to intrude upon the special moment with Kate and Claire.
Right.
Which are, of course, just convenient explanations for why they're not going to mess with themselves. So,
but I mean, sooner or later, somebody is going to break that rule. Somebody is not going to go where Daniel tells them to go, and they're going to see themselves. And I'm wondering what is going to happen when they run into themselves.
I absolutely hope you're right. I hope you're right, because I'm actually starting to get a little frustrated, because if they literally somehow skirt this entire paradox issue by just conveniently not being where they're supposed to be, that just drives me bonkers. But I think what they're doing is explicitly showing you that there's a sense that running into yourself and messing with the past is very dangerous. The fact that they're going through all these machinations is building the tension so that when that inevitable confrontation occurs, when that inevitable mess with paradox occurs, that we really sense how dangerous it is. And in fact, again, we've had talk about rules and not breaking them, and then Daniel Faraday, definitely by implanting a thought in Desmond's head that he just suddenly remembers, is an example of that.
Right. So, Jin, is he jumping around in time as Sawyer and Juliet them are?
Ah, yeah.
Or, I mean, where is he?
Well, when is he? He's in 1980 something or other when Rousseau shipwrecks. But that's an excellent question. Is he tied to the people that we see jumping around? Is he tied to the island and is permanently in the 1980s, or is it something else? I mean, actually, one of the biggest questions, and it also comes up in You All Everybody, is how is he time traveling, or how has he at least moved once back to the 80s? Because if the freighter was outside of the radius and the helicopter had to fly back to and still ended up outside the radius, then there's no question that he shouldn't have been included in the time jumping.
Right.
So my only explanation for how Jin can end up on the island in the 80s is that he did not time jump and move around by being inside the radius. He pulled a dead doctor. He just floated through the whatever,
and
through the barrier.
And he's not on the bearing.
Right. He floated in, hit the barrier of some kind, and because of the bearing he came in, boom, 1980, whatever. That's how I figure it. So in that case, he's not time jumping around. He's not following Charlotte and Juliet and Sawyer around. In fact, he has now made a single one-way trip to the history of the island, and he's going to be stuck with Daniel Rousseau and them in their time period when they shipwrecked.
Right.
That's
okay.
My only thought.
I mean, I hadn't even thought about the bearing.
Right.
I hadn't
even
considered that as like a part of the equation.
Well, so thankfully we had the dead doctor and we had the rocket test that Miles showed us that says, okay, bearing also can move you around through time.
So we heard the numbers on the radio.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool.
But in the background, you know, could have missed it. But
true, but also it was a male voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think was it a male voice when we first hear a broadcast? I think it's Saeed. He has the radio. He hears Rousseau. She has her, like, they're all dead message. But then it's a female voice reading off numbers. So it's
it's a male voice reading off numbers, but it's not the numbers. It's the number of iterations of that particular message. And from that, Saeed is able to calculate how long Rousseau's message has been playing.
Yeah, it's just an incrementing number. And it is a male voice. You're right.
Yes.
So in fact, what happened is, I guess, Rousseau's emergency broadcast overwrote the part of the male voice that's reading the 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42 portion.
Yeah.
But still the incrementing time part. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Okay, well, so I guess I'm not as excited, or maybe I'm even more confused than I was. But I thought that was excellent, because when we were first talking about Lost and we first talking about this broadcast, it reminds everybody of the numbers stations, which are a real actual phenomenon here on planet Earth, mysterious broadcasting stations all around the planet that sort of read off kind of random sequences of numbers.
But they're not random.
Right, I mean, right.
They go in a sequence.
Right, and the mathematists and conspiracy theorists love these number broadcasting stations, and they believe that it's part of a massive spy network. And in fact, there's a lot of great articles in Wikipedia and a couple of books about these things. So what I love with this reveal, with this radio in the French person's hands, is that it wasn't just Rousseau's voice and a sequence of incrementing numbers, that broadcast was originally a mysterious broadcast of a sequence of numbers. I think that's kind of great.
That is great. So now that we've seen Sawyer see something that happened in the past on the island.
Right, Claire and Kate giving birth to Aaron.
It makes you think of the whispers. Do you think the whispers are the survivors talking to each other?
I think that's the most reasonable explanation for the whispers that we've had. If it's either them talking to each other in the proximity of, or it's them in being in the same place during or near to a time shift that their voices carry, you know, throughout, and they just seem mysterious and seem maybe even backwards because they're there, but not really. I mean, I really like that that connection there. What I'm wondering though is the fact that they didn't see each other, or that, you know, Sawyer didn't call attention to himself, so maybe that's not the case. But I'm wondering if it comes to the point where our characters come face to face with themselves or others of themselves in the past, if they could interact. Maybe in fact they can't. Maybe what we're going to see is Sawyer's going to find past Sawyer and he's going to run up and try to yell at him like, don't do that, but the Sawyer that we
all
see
that we'll hear is whispers.
You'll either see whispers that, oh, turns out they can't run into each other, that in fact the paradox is kind of impossible because there's some sort of barrier. Maybe it's the intervention of the universe preventing it to happen, and the furthest they can go is a whisper. So I think that's kind of
I would actually like that a lot better than them running into themselves.
Right, instead of saying, hey, you're me, you know, it's just Sawyer trying to scream at Jack or Kate, don't get on the helicopter, but all they hear is whispers. I think that's kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. So that whole Ajira Airways water bottle in the canoe thing was pretty intriguing.
Yeah, I loved it. And I mean, think the most likely conclusion there, and one that I posted on the blog and a number of people shared that theory, was that, of course, it was a bottle placed there by the most recent, or actually most future, arrivals to the island, the Oceanic Six, having returned on another airline.
Of course it is.
Of course. I think that, but I think that that's also really, really cool that they, because our island folks have been jumping back and forth, why can't they jump past a point that we're seeing the current Oceanic Six running around trying to get to the island? So I think that the natural extension of that is that when they're on the ocean and they're paddling and they're suddenly chased by people in another canoe, I think that's the Oceanic Six chasing them.
It is.
And we had a caller, Jesse, Dave from Toronto, Rob from Rochester, a number of people on the blog said, yes, that's got to be them. The two most common theories for who was chasing them on the canoe is it's either the Oceanic Six, for whatever reason, chasing after people who've stolen their other canoe, or it's in fact themselves, that it's actually Sawyer, Juliet, Miles, them on another canoe in another sequence chasing themselves. I'm not sure how likely that is.
Well, the second scenario just really... doesn't it just make your brain hurt?
It makes my brain hurt. Also, I think that it was very key that Juliet, although she's on a boat being paddled furiously on rough waters, can turn around, point a gun, and knock someone off that other canoe. The person on the other canoe was a lousy shot, the closest getting to poking a hole in Sawyer's paddle.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it'd be kind of funny if it's themselves, because then Juliet or someone's a lousy shot that isn't, you know, in the other canoe. So I kind of like it being the Oceanic Six instead. But the canoe raises an excellent question, which is, we just found out that if you've got something with you when you first start time jumping, it stays with you, hence Zodiac. And then we had the question about the compass that Locke gives to
Alpert,
and we thought that we were going to get away from the infinite compass problem by having that compass also disappear when Locke disappears. But now the canoe that they're paddling away in, that there's suddenly a time jump and they're still in the canoe, they're not suddenly loose in the water. So why did the canoe go with them? I mean, is it part of their... I can't figure that out.
I can't either. I mean, this comes up, it seems like it comes up a lot with the canoe, with the Zodiac, with the compass, and I can't figure out the rules. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners totally understand it, but I'm not quite there yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If the things that they've got with them stay with them, then Alpert loses the compass when Locke disappears. But we also believe that Alpert later shows Locke the same compass, although it's not the same compass. And now we have a canoe that was not on the beach when our friends last were there, but now arrives in the future. Maybe it's because it's in the future. Maybe it's because they jumped ahead of themselves, that paradox doesn't exist, and so they can keep the canoe with them going back. I don't know. It's really, you're right. Definitely something that hopefully gets answered in a future episode. And now I'm starting to get a nosebleed.
Well, I am no shipper. Okay. Mm-hmm. I am no shipper in any way, shape, or form, except I'm tiny little bit of a skater.
You're a skater. We've outed you as a skater a long time ago. So this was definitely a skater episode. Yes. I think. I mean, it had that great line where Kate says, "I've always been with you, Jack." But now we have the inverse of that, which is Sawyer repeatedly, actually, I would say almost too overtly, demonstrating his affection for Kate, and to the point where even Locke is calling him on his affection for Kate. But what I want to know, despite the fact that that was a great skater moment, was what the heck is Juliet up to?
I don't know.
Juliet asking, "So tell me, James, how did it feel to see her again?" You know, like, why is she so suddenly interested in his feelings for her?
Well, maybe she feels like if she can get him to open up, and he feels like he can open up to her, it makes them closer. You know what I mean?
So you think that Juliet might have designs on Sawyer?
Who wouldn't?
Okay. Well, it's just when I watched that scene, it seemed that she was prying a little beyond just, you know, casual interest. It suddenly seemed like Juliet was functioning in a different motivation. Maybe she's interested in Sawyer, so she's basically trying to gauge if Sawyer is going to still be hung up on this Kate person, but it seemed like something else. I don't know. I mean, I love Elizabeth Mitchell, and the fact that that scene is so ambiguous is delicious, but I can't help pondering what she could possibly be up to.
So, in terms of Easter eggs, we had the van, the side of the carpet van.
Ah, the Canton Rainier carpet van. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you've been watching Lost for any period of time, you know that any weirdly hard-to-pronounce name is gotta be
an anagram. Yeah.
So, what we have is?
Reincarnation.
So, I kind of like that. Of course, it can also strike fear into the hearts of Lost fans if that's what's actually going on. You know, but again, I think we had that same reaction when time travel came up, which is, are they really going to go there? And so far, I think they're doing okay, and we're all along for the ride. So what do you think? Reincarnation would lock in the van?
Well, see, I really love that, and a lot of people really love that, but somebody on our blog pointed out, D from Makiki, and Makiki was our neck of the woods once, it was kind of cool. He pointed out that Canyon Rental is a rental company here in Hawaii. Uh-huh. And it's probably just a very cleverly painted Canyon Rental van.
I wholeheartedly disagree. I mean, for one, it doesn't look like a Canyon Rental van, although I kind of love that thought. But two, it's too prominently painted. I mean, true, I guess that means that there must be a fan out there trying to figure out what Rainbow Drive-In means, because of course it's an actual drive-in here. But no, I'm not willing to believe that Canton Rainier is accidental. Although serious anagram fans would be like, well, what's the hyphen for? But still, a nice thought. Reincarnation, yes or no? I don't necessarily think that it's a hint that there's reincarnation going on, but if it's going to be something about someone coming back from a possibly dead state, that's probably a likely end result of this season.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure what else. Well, we can cover some of the locations that were filmed in this episode. I love seeing what they do to Hawaii to make it look like other places. Not surprisingly, downtown LA, where Kate was downtown Honolulu. And they describe the intersection of Olive and Wilshire, which is actually the intersection of Alakea and South King Streets. And in fact, I watched them film that scene. And if you Google on YouTube or whatever, you can see some video clips shot of that scene from a distance. It was pretty cool. The exterior of the hospital, once again, that's the outside of Hawaii Medical Center East on Liliha Street, and the inside of the hospital was again Kahuku Hospital, a frequently used location by them. But the motel, that was a new one for them. The motel where they find Claire's mom is actually an apartment complex right next to Gehi Lagoon Park by Lagoon Drive near the airport. And I just went down to visit there. I sure wish I had seen Claire's mom when I saw that scene being filmed. What else was there?
Hurley's Jail.
Ah, Hurley's Jail. So this was kind of cool. Hurley's Jail cell, and was mentioned in a forward cabin, was mm-hmm. the Kaneohe District Park building. So actually, normally in that hallway where you saw the prisoners walking through, you've got kids in wet swimming suits passing through. So that's kind of cool. But more interestingly enough, that open ocean scene, that wonderful chase scene, that beautiful canoe scene, that was a scene that we watched film inside the Kaneohe District Park pool.
Yep.
So that was kind of awesome. Green screened and blacked out so they could sort of mix in the background, but really they're in a blue chlorinated Olympic style pool paddling for their lives in a stationary canoe. And as Jen is saying, it was, I think, one of your favorite moments, definitely, as Lost fan here on the island. We actually snuck out late at night to watch them film that. She had to go back to bed, but I definitely won out by sticking around, because I also saw Jin got pulled out of the water.
But... And then I found out Jin got pulled out of the water, so it wasn't really a big shock.
No, no. But still, a very good episode, and again, always good to see Hawaii on Lost. Well, that's our extensive two cents for this episode of Lost. When we come back, we're going to turn it over to...
You all, everybody.
Aloha, Ryan and Jen. Jerry from Kentucky. Let me just say, sham wow. Last night's show was awesome. Jen is alive. I'm so happy. I always suspected that he was still alive, but I was starting to have my doubts. But the show has been so great that I kind of lost track of it, actually. Don't really have any theories or anything, but I just wanted to say that I think this season is now going to be the best season ever. It just keeps on getting better and better. Love the show. Bye.
We start off there with a great call from Jerry in Kentucky, who says, sham wow. Sham wow indeed. And we should use that chamois to buff the head of Mr. Clean on Lost. Who can forget Jin? Definitely there's a lot to distract you, but we're absolutely thrilled that he's back.
Yes, I am.
And I agree. You know, the trajectory looks good. There's some ups and downs. It's still a bumpy ride, but that's Lost. But so far, season 5 is looking up.
It's already my favorite.
All right.
So here are three calls from John from North Carolina, Heath, and Angela from New York.
Hey, Ryan, Jen, what's up, man? It's John from North Carolina. I don't know, man. I don't know what it is about Kate episodes. They just don't do it for me. I think this was actually worse than Eggtown. I just didn't like it at all. No, I'm just playing. Holy freaking crap, dude. I mean, season 5 so far is just kicking some butt, man. I mean, I think this was, like, on par with Jughead. I think this was just as good as last week's episode. I mean, it was just crazy, man. I mean, I can't believe, I had no idea Jin was even going to be on the show anymore. I mean, that was like last week when we found out Widmore was on the island. I was just like, dang. I don't know what's up with, I think Claire's mom knows a little bit more than she's leading on. I think that her and Ben's got something going on, because I don't see why they would bring her back in the show unless just to fool us. But anyway, keep up the good work, and I'll talk to y'all next week.
Hello, Transmission. It's Heath from the Lost Revisited podcast. Oh, I just finished watching Two Princes, Beth Spin Doctor Song. No, The Little Prince. Wow. I'm shaking a little bit. Excited. This episode, I was getting sick of the Oceanic 6 a little bit. Was glad we had a break, but this one was awesome. A couple great reveals, of course. Russo and Jin knows the name, and Jin's like, oh, man, it's good to see Jin back. Sawyer was hilarious. And then the reveals that Ben did the whole Aaron thing. It's great. For once, my theories are starting to come true. But one thing I'm really glad is everyone, when Charlotte was getting a bloody nose, everyone's like, oh, she needs to find her constant. I'm like, no, don't go there, guys. It's about duration of the island. Something's going on. We got Miles and now Juliet. So who knows? But I knew it wasn't constant stuff, but I've heard it on so many podcasts. Oh, she's got to find her constant, and not at all. Anyway, great episode. What do you guys think? The Russo reveal, outstanding. All right, I'll keep listening. Namaste.
Hey, Ryan and Jen. This is Angela from New York. I just finished watching The Little Prince. I'm sure you guys eventually will or have done it. Anyway, sorry. I have a little crackpot theory. The episode, in my opinion, was good, but not great, not as great as last week was. But one thing that stood out for me was the Ajira Airway water bottle and the little raft that Julia had picked up. In the alternate reality game, the Ajira Airway website had a bunch of reviews by a man named Antonio B. McCutcheon. And McCutcheon is obviously Widmore's favorite brand of whiskey. My theory is that Ajira is owned by Widmore, and either the water bottle that they had found was from a past or future attempt by Widmore to get back to the island with a crew of people with his own airline. All right, Sorry, I think I'm getting a cold, and I'm going to go to sleep now. I love the podcast. Hope you guys are all doing well. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks for those calls. Hope you feel better there, Angela.
Yeah.
Good golly.
Yeah, drink some juice.
Our regular caller now, John, bringing us back up to the holy freaking crap level. And what do you think, though? Is Claire's mom actually in on the deal? Is she just messing with us? Is she working with Ben?
No, it was just a red herring.
I agree. I think that she was brought in just to mess with us, as difficult that is to believe now that they've killed off Frogert in his first appearance on the show. I think that it is quite possible that they're going to give us a character we know and love just as a red herring. So, sorry about that. Although, you know, I'm willing to be proven wrong. Well, here's the thing. Now that Jack shows up at the hotel and says, we did this all for Aaron, and she goes, who's Aaron? I think if she has any time to think about that conversation, she'll be like, wait a minute. What's this?
Well, yeah, eventually she is going to put one and one together, but...
You don't think that she was in the game at that point?
No.
Right, I agree. Our friend Heath from The Lost Revisited also pointing out the satisfaction that there's going to be a difference between finding your constant and your time-traveling brain versus just moving around on the island physically and time-traveling. Although, as we've determined, I don't think it's fully explained just yet.
No, we haven't even got... I don't think we've even gotten to, like, the whole story with the nosebleeds.
I hope that doesn't come down to having to have a pie chart or a graph or something, a Venn diagram, because that would just mess me up. And finally, Angela, who points out that the Ajira Airways was, of course, a alternative reality element. Mm-hmm. We didn't really keep up with any of those games.
No.
But there was an airline site. You could book tickets on everything. But that the McCutcheon was a reviewer. So, you know, I think that liquor company is certainly going to return as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we've got more calls. Kyle, Evan, and Robin.
Hey, this is Kyle from Idaho. Just finished watching The Little Prince. I nearly wet myself with glee when it was revealed that Jin was still around. Very happy about that. But watching these episodes with all the time shifts going on and the mention of rules, specifically in the season premiere when Dr. Marvin Candle was talking with the worker who had suggested, what are you going to do, go back in time and stop Hitler? And the doctor just said, no, of course not, there are rules. It reminded me of the scene from, it was the season 4 episode, I think it was The Shape of Things to Come, when Alex was killed, and Ben just sits there for a moment in shock, and then mumbles, he changed the rules. He, of course, referring to Charles Widmore. Can we conclude from that through time shifts somehow, Ben knows the course of events that are going to be occurring on the island, and that the rules that Charles Widmore broke was he manipulated time somehow and resulted in Alex being killed? It's one of those things that makes my brain hurt, and I'm already getting a headache, so I'll end it there.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, it's Evan from the mainland, just calling about the new episode of Lost. So I just wanted to get your opinion on something. We obviously find out that Jin's alive, found by a younger Danielle Russo. So now, do you think that when Sun eventually is going to find out about Jin being alive, do you think that she's going to keep going on with her less than nice ways of dealing with those who she thinks is responsible for Jin's death? Or do you think that she's just going to stop and become the nice, lovable son that we have grown to love and just try to move on through life? So just let me know what you guys think, and love the podcast. Bye.
Hi, Ryan and Jen. This is Robin from the TVCritic.org. I wondered if you thought Locke was acting a tiny bit like Ben when he asks Sawyer if he thinks they should go to the Orchid, and then kind of leans on him by saying, come on, you know you want to help me get the others back. Don't you want Kate back? And I just thought that kind of emotional manipulation seemed more like Ben than Locke. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Mahalo for those calls. And hey, what you thought about Kyle mentioned about the rules?
That actually makes a lot of sense in the context of what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think even when we discussed that intense bedroom confrontation, we figured that the rules were messing with the rules of time. But it was good to be reminded of it because of the mention of the rules that Marvin Candle talks about. So The question is, what is the incident? Because now Ben is genuinely shocked that his daughter died.
Right.
At the hands of Kimi. So something happened prior to that, presumably, that made it possible for his daughter to die. So now I'm wondering where the rules were changed. And in fact, if it's something that Widmore in the present is setting into action in getting someone back to the island, that's going to cause this rule to change, or did I just talk into a circle? that Ben was confident nothing was going to happen to Alex, but something did. So what was that change?
I have no idea.
That'd be kind of cool to see. Evan from the mainland asks if you think Sun's going to get nicer.
No, you know what? I love Sun, and I grew to love her in season one, but I'm realizing now that she has a little bit of a cruel, mean, lying, sadistic streak. And I think that's just how she is.
I think that unless her character is going to somehow make a U-turn between season 5 and season 6, we've seen a consistent progression of Sun's character from put upon and innocent to actually conniving and evil.
I mean, I'm telling you, when she was saying to Kate, "That's what friends do."
Yeah, you get shivers up your spine.
You know, I don't know. I'm starting to change my mind about Sun.
That was a nice psycho effect, by the way. But yeah, no, I don't think that it's true that if eventually Sun finds out that Jin is still alive, or at least lived at some point in the distant past, and survived the freighter explosion, obviously, then it kind of takes away the motivation she has for being really, 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 really mad. But I don't think that that will stop her from being a mad person.
No.
Absolutely. And finally, Robin, our friend from the TVCritic.org, kind of pointing out that, you know, Locke is getting a little manipulative, just like Ben is.
You become what you hate.
I think that that's definitely a good observation. And I think that that might, in fact, be a trait that you inherit as becoming the leader of the others. You have to learn how to con people.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's your job. You know?
Well, I mean, the thing about, you know, teaching people that do give someone an idea but make them think it was their idea, that's something that both Sawyer and Ben have said in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a skill that Locke has already put into play, but definitely a good link.
Here are three calls from Andy, Mario, and Tara.
Hey, Ryan and Jen. This is Andy from St. Louis. And first off, I want to say I love your podcast. You guys are one of only two fan podcasts I listen to regularly. I've heard a lot of the others, but I think you guys do a fantastic job. And now on to tonight's episode, The Little Prince. I thought it was great. Any episode that has a lot of Kate in it is definitely going to be one that I like. But I did have a question, though. At the end, when they revealed that Jin was still alive and he was with Danielle Russo and the rest of her team, obviously he knows who she is. When they were showing Russo in the past, when she was older on the island with the rest of the Losties, did she ever indicate that she knew who Jin was? I'm not very good at keeping up with that kind of stuff, but I know you guys are. So hoping you can answer my question for me, and I look forward to hearing the podcast. Have a great time. Bye.
Aloha, Ryan and Jim. It's Mario calling again from Houston, Texas. And last night's episode, The Little Prince, was another great episode of Lost. I guess for me, the biggest reveal was, in fact, that Jin is alive. We've all suspected it. And that the creators did follow through with their promises of letting us see Russo's story. I mean, showing us a young Russo. I am curious to know why that connection with Jin is overlooked in the future. And I guess my own theory on that is maybe she's so rattled by solitary confinement over so many years that her only focus is Alex and has no recollection of actually meeting Jin. My two favorite quotes from this episode, you know, in all the different movies we've seen, 12 Monkeys, Donnie Darko, Star Trek and Next Generation, Back to the Future, no one has had such a great line about the experience that Sawyer did in this episode when he said, "Time travels a bitch." And I also like the line by Locke when he's talking to Sawyer and he says that, "I needed that pain to get me to where I am now." I think that was a cool little shout out to Star Trek: The Final Frontier when Kirk tells Bones the exact same thing about Cybok. So, again, you guys have the best podcast on the internet. Keep it coming. Continue listening all season.
Hi, Ryan and Jen. This is Tara from PA. I just watched the latest episode of Lost. The fact that Jin somehow, this is the second time he somehow managed to survive in the open ocean for, I guess, days. I mean, the first time, I guess, wasn't quite as long, right in the beginning of the second season after the raft blew up. We, you know, remember they lost Jin, and I guess we all assumed he was dead, but they suddenly found him on the island. I'm starting to think that maybe there's something about him that, you know, because it really is impossible for that to happen, and now it's happened to him twice. I don't know if it's just a coincidence. I'm starting to think he has gills or something, like, maybe the fact that his father's a fisherman, maybe he, I don't know, washed up on shore someday. He's actually like a merman. But I don't know. I just think it's interesting that this is the second time that's happened. It probably means nothing, but you never know. Yeah, so I love your podcast, and I look forward to hearing your next one. Bye.
Some great calls there, focusing on our good friend Jin, and Andy and Mario with the same question. Why doesn't Danielle Russo remember Jin when we first meet her in season one or two, if now we see that he's spent at least a little bit of time with her crew back in the 1980s?
Well, I mean, she basically has gone insane, right?
True, true. I guess if all of the marbles fall out of your head, that you're not going to remember something like that. So that could be it.
Right.
I think another possibility is that it could be the Faraday-Desmond issue, where she didn't remember him then, but she does now. I mean, basically, the memory would pop into her head that didn't exist.
Yeah.
But that really gets my head tied into a knot. The third possibility is I really thought back. Jin and Russo spent any significant amount of time together. She only came to the beach camp once or twice, once after Aaron, and once to, you know, kind of go bring them to go see something. But I don't think she had a direct confrontation with Jin in any case. And in all of the scenes where they've dealt with Danielle running around in the forest, Jin was not part of those kind of jungly expeditions. So maybe she just doesn't remember him because she really didn't see him in earlier on in the season. So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think someone with far more time than us should go back and try to find a Danielle and Jin in same scene, but I can't remember one. So
I can't either. Not really off the top of my head.
So the explanation might be that simple. And finally, Tara says, hey, what's this deal with Jin? He's been blown off a boat with explosives twice and has managed to mysteriously survive. What do you think is going on there?
Well, you can't die if the island isn't done with you.
Yeah, I'm not sure what she was saying about her dad and being a merman, but essentially I think that the idea that you can't die until your work is done is one thing that we could be seeing here. If Michael can't point a gun at his head and blow his old brain out, then that might be the most simple explanation for how Jin could have survived an actual explosion of the freighter.
That's my guess is that they're just not done with him yet.
So I wonder what that means in the long term, but still, good thoughts. Three more calls now from Alex, Jesse, and Steve.
Hey guys, it's Alex in Boston. A couple of quick thoughts on The Little Prince. I think the episode for me had less impact than the writers and producers were intending it had. A lot of the revelations felt like stuff I already knew, and I'm generally a pretty spoiler-free guy, but I think it was common knowledge that we were going to see the Russo crew at some point pretty soon. I mean, many hints have been dropped on that, and the impact of it was just not that great for me because not a whole lot happened. Also, I think it was a pretty safe bet that we were going to see Jin again, so there again, I didn't feel too blown out of my socks. The off-island Oceanic 6 stuff was better than I expected, faster moving and more dramatic. The on-island stuff, which I usually like more, was this week a little bit sort of slow moving, a lot of sort of meandering around the island with some vague destination and a lot of conversation. And the stuff with Sawyer seeing Kate and all his Sturm und Drang about that and talking to Juliet about how he feels, it really felt like a transparent effort to go after the female demographic and the romance-hungry demographic, and to me it was just incredibly disappointing stuff. The overall episode I thought was fine, but I just really resent the pandering to that perceived audience. So, not a bad episode, not a great one. I do like the overall trajectory of the season and how it's moving pretty quickly. So, thanks a lot. Keep up the great work.
Oh, boy. Ryan and Jen, it's Jesse again, and I have to say, I hate Kate-centered episodes. And you know what? It's not even a Kate-centered episode, really, but I think just because it focused on her and her whimpering and crying and baby issues. I love you, Kate, but your episodes suck. Now, this is not to say this was a bad episode. I actually enjoyed it when it was on the island. Everything that happened off the island, I could care less about. The fact that Ben was behind it all, of course he was. He's Ben. That's obvious. But the island was the best part. The light, right when Locke's banging on the light, and then Sawyer seeing Kate and Claire give birth, and then Russo and Jin, amazing. Loved it. That's all I gotta say about that. I wanna just end by saying, John Locke seems way too eager to die. Like, he's like, I'll do whatever it takes to bring him back. I'm starting to think that he has a plan on the, like, Ben scheme, like, really high up. I'm starting to think he's going to use that serum that the spiders produce that killed off Paulo and Nikki but didn't really kill them, so they were buried alive. He's going to use that to trick them.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, this is Steve Freese from Las Vegas. I was a reporter that did the piece on pod fading a while ago, and of course I'm thrilled that you're not actually pod fated. But I had a few thoughts. I haven't called you guys in a while, and I had a few thoughts regarding loss, and I wanted to kind of throw them out there. They're really more questions than actual theories. First of all, you know, Minkowski and Teresa and the Rat and a few other folks, when they were time jumping in the present, they were unconscious, or they were sort of in a sort of a semi-conscious stupor. And I wonder if our losties, while they're time jumping, are actually just laying there unconscious on the beach in, in the present day. That's one thing. Secondly, maybe that moment, I can't remember which episode it was, but there was a moment where Locke is being pulled, like, into a hole or something a number of years ago, and he looks up and he sees something astonishing and, you know, beautiful to him. Maybe he sees himself. Maybe that's the moment where he gets it, you know? And the other thing that's been killing me, I was wondering about, you know that Nikki and Paulo were unimportant characters, because would that not have been the most perfect moment when Miles arrives on the island and he's supposed to be sensing distressed souls, right? And who would be more distressed than these two people who were buried alive? But they never got to it. They never cared about it. And it's just kind of one of those dumb things I thought of. Anyway, keep up the great show. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for those calls. Well, with a dissenting view, Alex there saying that he wasn't altogether that impressed, that it didn't hit him as hard as it looks like they wanted it to, and specifically that the whole thing with Sawyer, Juliet, and Kate and Jack is just a little too mushy for his taste.
Well, I agree on the Sawyer, Juliet, Kate, and whoever stuff, because I've never really been that into the whole love, whatever shape it is this week. I agree with that. I was much more compelled by what was going on in the island.
You got to admit, there's a significant portion of this show's demographics, and you might call it pandering if it's not your interest, but I think that when they go into the time travel and the Dharma Initiative and scientists and polar bears, probably the people who are interested in the relationships are like, give me a break, stop it with this geek stuff, and, you know, give us the relationships.
Then they can go watch Grey's Anatomy.
Oh my, let's not go there. But I definitely think that what we're going to be seeing more and more, and this is going to be inevitable for the rest of Lost, is that as they start closing loops and making connections, many of them are going to be things that we've predicted or put together on our own.
Yeah,
it is inevitable that we're going to be like, well, I knew that. So to some extent, I think the creators are kind of putting themselves into a bind as they're not painting themselves into a corner, but they're painting into their last corner, and eventually there's not going to be too many more places for them to go that'll shock us. But definitely, you know, it's always good to hear another point of view. Jesse giving us a call again. It's nice to have regulars here on the show.
Jesse has a great voice, doesn't he?
Oh, well, and certainly he loves, I mean, we edit his comments down significantly. So, Jesse, we've done this to other folks and it's worked. So why don't we say this to you as well?
It's your
time
own
to
podcast.
Start your own podcast. Well, listen, absolutely. But no, we're glad for you to call in. And he shares your disdain, I think, for Kate's general character. So that's kind of cool. But he mentions the spiders from Nikki and Paulo, and so does Steve from Las Vegas. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Steve, it's great to hear from you, because it's because of you that we became more famous for quitting our podcast than actually having our podcast. But we're back and we're glad to have you listening. But I think that's true. We've got someone who walks over graves and hears distressed characters. Why not Nikki and Paulo?
We're not done with Nikki and Paulo yet. I mean, I know everybody hated them and they killed them off for a reason, but we're not done with Nikki and Paulo yet.
I think that at the very least, if they're going to bring Claire's mom back to mess with you, if they're going to bring back Frogert to blow him up, they're going to bring back Nikki and Paulo again, just to mess with us, maybe just to give the fans a tweak. And I'm sorry, this is the entire reason why we lost our Lost license, but I thought that the episode that killed off Nikki and Paul was one of the best episodes ever.
You think so?
No. Okay, I'll stop. Anything else there? Well, I mean, Steve also raises the point that he's confused, as many of us are, as whether they're time jumping and leaving bodies behind. Or is there a camp full of unconscious Sawyers, Juliets, and Locks because their minds are on this trip? And I don't think that's the case.
I don't think so.
I think what we're running into is this is not mind jumping like Minkowski and Desmond. This is body jumping, and it's something else. But again, there's probably a Venn diagram in that. Finally, a simple question from Bryce.
Hi guys, big fan, Bryce from Arizona. Just curious if anyone has translated the French conversations from Daniel Rousseau's team. I'd love to know what they were saying. Love the show. Thanks, guys. Bye.
An excellent question there, Bryce, and fortunately we've got an answer for you.
Odette on our blog and Benny over at Nikki Stafford's blog, Nick at Night, have translated the French stuff.
Awesome.
Somebody says, we never should have followed those damn numbers. Someone replies, it's not my fault. Brennan was at the sonar. Brennan says, if you listen to Montan, he said that the instruments malfunctioned. Danielle calls out, man at sea when they spot Jin. Robert says, what? I thought we were all there. Someone else says, we are. It's not one of ours. They paddle to him and pull him in. Someone else says, someone observes, there's only him, no boat, nothing. But they say he's still breathing. When they reach the island, Montan points to the radio and says, Robert, look, the signal is coming from the island. Robert asks if he can determine the source and whether he thinks the island is inhabited.
So a lot of really good stuff there, not translated or subtitled at all.
Nope.
But significant in the sense that, those mysterious number signals, again, like maybe one of many number signals that people haven't been able to explain on the planet, these French adventurers or scientists were following them or looking to find one of the numbers, and that's why they got too close to the island, their instruments malfunctioned, and they end up shipwrecked. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, it's great to see that we're going to be hearing more about, hopefully, Daniel Rousseau's story. Well, we have moved into an hour here at the transmission, so we'll quickly try to get to some of the comments on our blog and by email.
Michael281 writes on the blog, I like the idea that the canoe found was from the returning Losties. If we go with that, why must we assume that the pursuing canoe was filled with the same people? For example, the Oceanic Six return, run around the island, and stir up some trouble. They're pursued. They give their pursuers the slip, and those pursuers think that the Oceanic Six have grabbed a canoe and gone back out to sea, so they will grab the other one and pursue, shooting at the first canoe.
I think that's a possibility, but isn't it more interesting that it would be the Oceanic Six? Although,
yeah.
One of the questions asked on the blog is, if you were Sawyer, Daniel, Locke, and them, why would you leave the second canoe there to get yourself chased? But in any case, a good comment. Martha from Mexico emails and says, those canoes look just like the one Sawyer and Kate escaped from the smaller island, the one that Carl used to go and warn the Losties, and also the one Charlie and Desmond take at the end of season 3 to go to the underwater hatch. I think that was in Greatest Hits.
Right.
So certainly these canoes are not unfamiliar to us, but it's what was in them that was more intriguing to us.
Right. Connie in Alaska writes on the blog, lots of questions. Will Rousseau's group time shift with the island Losties? My guess would be no. The island group shifts to the other's timelines, never vice versa. Did Ben, knowing Kate, set up the whole scenario with Claire's mom and his lawyer, knowing she would follow the lawyer and see Mrs. Littleton and then freak out? My guess is that Ben didn't count on Jack joining up with Kate and finding out that Mrs. Littleton is clueless about Aaron. He just wanted to give Kate a good reason to hide out by returning to the island.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I agree that Rousseau's group is not going to be jumping around. I mean, basically, I think they're where they were in the island's history, and we're going to finally get to see what was going on there. But how many iterations, how many levels deep did Ben's conspiracy to meet with, to get Kate to run off with Aaron? I don't think it seems a little too implausible that it would include following them to the motel to find Claire's mom there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Claire's mom was an accident.
Yeah, and I think there's another question coming up about his plan with Saeed as well. Still, we move on to Jana, who emails and says, if Jin is time traveling along with Sawyer and Locke, and Locke has since left the island to convince each of the Oceanic Six to return to the island, wouldn't he have told Sun that Jin was alive to motivate her to come back? Since this obviously didn't happen, we should be able to assume that Locke and company don't run into Jin unless Locke separates from Sawyer and friends to do his own thing as usual. I don't think Sun would be as eager to shoot Ben and Jack if she knew that Jin was alive. What do you think?
Yeah, that's true. I think when she finds out that Jin is still alive, she's going to be less motivated to kill Ben, but
right.
She's still going to be evil.
Yeah, I think the thing about if you wanted to find something to use with them off the island to get them to come back, that would be Exhibit A. So the question is, why didn't Locke use that information, or how did Locke not have access to that information? But there's a lot of assumptions in the question as well, because if we assume that Jin is moving with them and that they're going to cross paths, I'm not necessarily sure if that's the case. It's just that it seems pretty likely that Jin appearing in the timeline with Rousseau's crew means that somewhere in the future on the island, somebody's going to come across an artifact that demonstrates that he showed up there.
Yeah.
But not necessarily that he's still there. So that could be something else entirely.
Painter Girl writes on the blog, I believe the surveillance folder, the box of chocolates, and the gun Sun received in the mail was from Ben. He's crafty enough to set up his own execution, confident he can talk himself out of it. He knew he'd be the only bait Sun would come after. I'm sure when Saeed went after Hurley, he thought he was doing something that was his idea. I'm sure it was really an idea Ben planted in his head.
Well, certainly the question about, you know, what is Saeed up to and why is he so fixated on helping Hurley, the fact that Ben asks him in the van, you know, why is it that you're going after Hurley, seems to me like he's seeking validation of a con that he put into place way early on to make Saeed obsessed with Hurley's safety.
Ben's a mastermind.
Absolutely. But, you know, the question about is Ben masterminding his own assassination at the hands of Sun? What do you think about that theory?
I think she has something there. I think he knows that that's the only way he's going to ever convince Sun to get over there.
Right. I mean, that's going to convince Sun to come to get him. That's not going to convince her to come to the island. So I guess, again, that's that piece of information that Jana mentions, which may or may not be the existence of Jin after the freighter explodes.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely good thoughts. Christy in Texas wrote on the blog, I get the feeling that Sun was already visited by Locke before his suicide and was told that Jin was alive and asked to work with Ben to trap Widmore for the future safety of the island and to convince Kate to go back to the island with Aaron. Sun convinced Kate to meet with the lawyer to eventually lead her to see Claire's mother and to be scared into running away. So here I think we're starting to get into the how far down the rabbit hole does it go, Ben's plan. In this scenario, there was the information provided to Sun that Jin was alive, but that the issue is more that that's how Sun is actually working with Ben to get Kate. And at that point, I just think it's a house of cards that's too easy to collapse. I'm wondering what the simplest explanation is for all of these things.
Bonita writes on the blog, I hope that Jin's time with the French will provide really cool opportunities for reveals, and I think the language barrier will create misunderstandings. This could be related to why Danielle goes crazy. Imagine Jin is trying to explain the vaccine thing or something about the Losty's experience, and this leads her to become paranoid when he suddenly disappears with a flash. Her not recognizing him later could be that she has seen many other ghosts.
That's a thought. I mean, we say that she lost her mind. Maybe spending time with a person who vanishes and reappears at whim might be why she's basically convinced that there's something going on. Certainly a good theory. Ilias writes on the blog, so Ben told Locke that the price that he has to pay is that he can never return to the island. It seems that this was another lie. He is devious, the little bug-eyed man, and everyone should know that by now. So is his only motivation to bring little Aaron back to the island? Is Locke and all the others only a means to get the little and only prince back to the island? There must be great significance to Aaron being the first child to be born on the island after such a long time.
Well, how do we know that he does go back?
I'm not sure. I mean, clearly he's definitely invested in getting the Oceanic Six back, but I've not got the impression so far that he plans to go with them.
No.
Even when he's talking to Mrs. Hawking,
uh-huh.
It does sound like he's basically trying to deliver them, not that he's going to go with them.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. The premise of that might be broken as it is, but I like the idea that Aaron is actually the central piece here, that Aaron is, again, Aaron is an Oceanic Six member. He's not discussed in these discussions about getting everyone to go back, but if they all have to go back, the baby has to go back, and then Sun, you know, conveniently brings Aaron with her because she has to come to try and assassinate Ben. So again, a possibility that this was all a great masterminded plan by Ben. It just seems so far-fetched, but maybe Ben is just that good.
MJ from the Midwest writes, it would seem that Ben doesn't want Saeed to go back to the island. He has tranked him once and tried a second time. So does this mean that not all of the Oceanic Six have to go back? And was Ben being truthful when he says that he can't?
So certainly, again, we don't know whether he's telling the truth about him not being able to go back, but I hadn't thought about the fact that if you're tracking how Ben is moving Kate along, how Ben may be moving Sun along, how Ben has definitely moved Jack along and will, I guess, drag Hurley along. What is the deal with what he's doing with Saeed?
Do we know that he's doing that to Saeed? I mean, I'm thinking it's some other agent at, you know, some other force at work here.
I don't know. That's true. Maybe the people who are trying to drug Saeed are Widmore, but if that were the case, when Ben walks in at the hospital and sees all this going on, it would seem he would be a little more upset that there's other motives at play than the ones that they are aware of. I had always assumed that, you know, what's happening to Saeed and, you know, getting rustled out of the safe house was part of the master plan that Ben has, but why the drugging when nobody else is getting drugged? Because if drugs are that effective, why not drug everybody? and drag them back to the island. Why is Saeed the one that has to be knocked out to be part of this? So a very good question. Well, I really wish that we could include every email and every comment that we get in our podcast. We had, again, over 120 comments for this one episode on our blog. We do read and listen to it all, even though we can't include it. And we would certainly encourage you to check out the blog for this great conversation that continues to unfold. I did want to mention that a lot of you mentioned the polar bear picture in Widmore's office and making the connection that the polar bear ending up in Tunisia probably means that the polar bear was the nice, cold, tolerant animal that could turn the frozen donkey wheel, and that's how they got things moving without losing people. So that was Wayne in New Jersey, Dixon from Tennessee, Omar from D.C., Raul from Wayne, New Jersey, and a really great comment or thread that a lot of people thought that they heard on the show was
the lawyer says that the ME confirmed that blah blah blah, not yummy.
Yes, but we're so eager to make those connections, but unfortunately no, that wasn't a yummy reference. And finally, John Fisher, a good friend of ours, he does the Lost site for about.com, came on our blog and basically summarized the plot of The Little Prince, which is a very old story by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Sorry, I should let you do all the French here, but it's worth a read. So again, come to our blog to see what The Little Prince was about and who the various characters connect to. It might not be the people that you think they are.
We love to hear from you, so get in touch with us in one of three ways. You can call us at 808-356-0127, drop us an email at lost@hawaiiup.com, or leave a comment on the blog at hawaiiup.com/lost.
Absolutely. Now, when you do leave a call, try to leave it before Friday, for one, and again, try to keep them short, maybe a minute, and although I'm sure you've got a list of six things, then we'd like to hear maybe one in detail, and that'd be more fun to talk about. We say Friday because after we get your feedback and we've collected it, we do try our best to even organize and process it all, so certainly it's a tight turnaround after an episode of Lost, but that's how fast we know your brains work. And that's it for you all, everybody. That means we're going to move now into the Forward Cabin.
This is where we hide production news, sightings, rumors, spoilers, and all kinds of fun stuff. So if you don't want to know what's coming up, you might want to skip ahead.
All right, Jen. Well, what did the deep-voiced ABC announcer say was coming up next week on Lost?
Ben says everyone on the island needs help. Locke says he's looking for a way off the island, and we see him falling down a hole. Mm. Ben tells Sun that Jin's still alive, and he can prove it. Kate says they're crazy. Sun points a gun at Ben. On the island, Sawyer's pointing a gun at a man, and he realizes that it's Jin.
Woohoo! That looks fantastic. The title of the episode is This Place is Death. The official ABC synopsis reads, Locke takes on the burden to stop the island's increasingly violent shifts through time. Meanwhile, Ben hits a roadblock in his attempt to reunite the Oceanic Six and bring them back to the island. So this week we have essentially one filming report, but it's a pretty detailed one, and it comes from a local friend here, Chris J, who was just basically spending three straight days following Lost around.
That sounds like fun.
It does sound like fun. I envy those that aren't tied to little desks in little cubicles all day. So Chris J caught them filming at Manoa Falls first on Wednesday. He saw a newer Dharma van there, and they were working basically down below the Paradise Park facility where the Orchid Station and cages were, so certainly that's going to be making a return. But the next 2 days were even more interesting. Chris J headed out to Camp Erdman, and he saw Othersville, of course, and this time it was all worn out, all torn and dirty, and we recently reported that condition in scenes. There were Losties in Dharma jumpsuits, but this time they're there as if a lot of time has passed since. So perhaps this is in the future, i.e. a Jira water bottle time. Now, there was a broken-down Dharma van, and he says he thought he also saw Claire's house. It's back, but still blown up. And Matthew Fox was there, or Jack, still clean-shaven, but looking a little more shaggy than usual. So, you know, hair growth being what it is, that's probably going to be a clue. Josh Holloway was there as well as some extras with guns, and somebody suggested that Sawyer was being held captive. And interestingly, Chris watched a scene where Sawyer was staking out one of the cabins, and while he's there, a little kid comes up and gives him something that looks like a notebook. So we definitely want to know what the notebook is, who the little kid is, although I think some people might have some theories. The next day, Chris returned to watch more filming, but they were on the other side of the camp, and this is where things were looking bright and new again. There were lots of happy Dharma extras, kids running around, a Dharma volleyball game, a barbecue, and a brand new Dharma van. He saw Ken Leung. Miles was there. He was also in a Dharma uniform, but with a star in the logo, like a security guard. Interestingly enough, Jorge Garcia or Hurley was there, and he had a chef's hat on his logo, which I guess is fitting, i.e. or possibly dangerous for him. I guess he's on the kitchen staff or something. And in the scene with Miles and Hurley, they were loading up a Dharma van. They were putting in some silver canister, checking some papers and driving off. And Hurley says, "Where are we going today?" So that's interesting. I guess they might be our next adventuring pair. Chris also saw Evangeline Lilly or Kate. She was not in a Dharma uniform, but she was talking to Roger Linus.
No way.
The dad of Ben. And so I guess this is in the past. They were standing in the playground. Roger hands Kate a Dharma beer. So they're looking pretty chummy. I don't know what's going on. And finally, as night fell, a dressed up Francois Chow. Marvin Candle himself turned up, dressed up as we know him. And apparently he was there for scenes with Miles.
Uh-huh.
So there was one offhand mention by someone that Chris heard as he left that it was a scene with a scientist and his son.
I knew
so it. So that may be what's coming up for maybe the 12th or 13th episode of Lost. I might have the number wrong, but it's definitely coming up. So lots of stuff happening over several days, but no telling where it all fits. I mean, it looks like basically we're going to see the island across a wide expanse of time with our Losties showing up in each one. Can't wait.
Sounds fascinating.
Absolutely. So that's it for this episode of The Transmission. And again, next week, we're going to tackle the next new episode of Lost.
The Transmission is powered by you, so speak up. Please comment on our blog at hawaiiup.com/lost. Send us an email to lost@hawaiiup.com or call the Lost line at 808-356-0127.
Remember that The Transmission is available in both MP3 and enhanced AAC format. And as we mentioned a couple of times, The Transmission this week and next is brought to you by audible.com, our first sponsor, so we'd certainly like to hear your thoughts on how that went. But if you want to pick up your free book when you sign up as part of the offer, that's audiblepodcast.com/transmission.
I would like to say a thank you quickly to Daniel from Boston for a really wonderful, awesome, heartwarming email that he wrote. Thank you, Daniel.
Absolutely. We love to know that the show is worthwhile for you because that's what makes it worthwhile for us. That's it, folks. Stay lost.
Aloha.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lost Podcasting Network. Get all your favorite Lost podcasts in one feed at lostcasts.blogspot.com.